It's Cofield and Company, live on location.
I'm a damn fool!
There's like 30 sandwiches here! What the f*** am I looking at?
Woman up.
Ooh! Ooh!
It's time for Cofield and Company with Steve Cofield on ESPN Las Vegas.
All right, here we go. 90 minutes on the way from here until running Rebel warm-up. We're getting ready for Purdue-Fort Wayne from the Summit. Five straight winning seasons. Solid program. Could be some jitters tonight with a bigger crowd for some of these newbies with UNLV running Rebels. Again, 7 o'clock tip. You can still make it down here. Lots of good seats available. They have all these cool initiatives that they've introduced this year around UNLV basketball. And one cool thing, when you come into the arena, you're going to notice that the jabronis, us in the media, are no longer sitting behind one of the baskets. This has been something people have talked about for, 12 or 15 years, that when the opposition is shooting at, we'll call it the, Northwest basket, whatever it is, the basket they shoot at in the second half, the media was sitting behind them.
Right.
And obviously we're not going to get up and start waving. So now the band is back there, more fans back there, so that's one of the big changes. Now the next step is to get crowds back in the building, including the students, and you know how that happens with winning and consistent winning, so we'll see if it starts tonight. Big Five time.
Battle Born Injury Lawyers presents the Big Five at Five. Number five.
I'm glad to have McKinnell here because the guy's a dynamo on satellite with all his fight talk with his wrestling show, and he's great on MMA. I like all of those as well, but we lean on you for expertise. What was the coolest moment of this last combat sports weekend? We had Canelo fight here in town. That was a dramatic ending. Oddities, it appeared on the scorecards.
Yeah.
There were weird goings-on in the MGM before the boxing match, and then we had this mega card at MSG in New York where the commission there ain't good. Ain't good.
No.
What was the best thing that you saw all weekend?
The best thing that I saw all weekend was Jorge Masvidal kind of reaching the heights of MMA stardom that I think a lot of us in the sport thought would be a real possibility.
I never thought it. You're right, I'm wrong. I thought he was a guy who would just settle in that sort of Donald Cerrone, trying to think of someone who's even less talented than that, but just kind of a gamer who you could rely on for, 20, 25 fights, would go, 14 and 11, but always bring it, always action. This is the great thing about mixed martial arts, and it can happen in boxing too, but unfortunately, boxing gets so down on fighters once they lose. In MMA, there's so many different disciplines. If guys stick to it, they can get better and better and better. And guys can sometimes reach their peak, even though when they start at 23 as a pro, they can reach it at 34. And he's a new fighter. This division was the glamour division, and he's the most glamorous guy in terms of fighting style and delivering wins.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at the way he's done it, and I would actually argue that he's kind of still what you thought he was, Steve. Like, I still think he's like a Cerrone character.
I always thought he was more of a points fighter. And it seems like now that this is another weird thing, too. Everyone's so into cutting weight and going smaller, 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 that sometimes you're just better off cutting a little less weight and retaining power. He's now a power puncher at 170 and like a really dangerous power puncher. And what a finisher. I mean, we saw a couple fights back, that flying knee across the ring in the first 10 seconds of the Ben Askren fight. I mean, this guy should be making tons of money.
Yeah.
They need to get him in lots of big fights, and he came through in one of probably the biggest of his career.
No question. You look at the you kind of named the lineage there, right? Ben Askren two fights ago. Prior to that, look what he did to Darren Till, who on Saturday night in the co-main event looked outstanding at middleweight, 15 pounds heavier than when Masvidal starched him earlier this year. So you're talking about three massive wins. And you brought up the point. He was a point fighter, and he talked about this leading up into this fight. Brett Okamoto, our friend, ESPN, did a great piece with him leading up to this, where he essentially said something clicked with me a few fights ago, where I realized I was looking at my fights and I'm going to split decision, split decision, split decision. I realized that I wasn't finishing. I wasn't going out there and doing what I was capable of. So he always had the killer's mentality. We're talking about a guy who grew up in Miami, who was a part of those Kimbo YouTube videos that fought in boatyards. I mean, as real as it gets, right? Yeah. Like, to use a UFC tagline. But he never had the attention. He never had the shine. Also, in credit to other promoters that maybe missed the boat, he never had the win streaks. It is a perfect storm of him putting together the win streaks to back up his personality, right? And that's why I actually liken him to a Donald Cerrone, because I think, you know, over the last couple fights, he's gotten that shine. Not to say Cerrone hasn't had that opportunity, but that's when we talk about Cerrone. I like the idea of him fighting maybe Conor McGregor next, because the UFC has a lot of Jorge Masvidals. They may be like five or six that are just on the surface, that have tons of character, that have tons of charisma, and for whatever reason, they're not latching on. They need the stage, they need the promotion, and thankfully for mixed martial arts as a whole, not just the UFC, Jorge Masvidal went out on Saturday night and did it. And Steve, you kind of touched on it. The fact that this sport, and I think it's one of the things that I love about this sport, and I know it's one of the things you love about this sport, where you can have two main eventers walking into Madison Square Garden on a million buy potentially pay-per-view that have 11 losses and 14 losses, respectively. There isn't another combat sport in the world that draws that sort of attention where people look past the losses to kind of ride with their favorites.
It's been proven people will look past it. And that's where, to me, the narrative of the weekend was where boxing is now versus MMA. You and I started covering this in the early 2000s, and I knew we were on to something. And I was also covering boxing at the time, and I love boxing. But Saturday night was, if the torch hadn't been passed already, that was the official passing of the torch. Not from a salary standpoint, because Canelo made a lot of money compared to these guys. But
right.
At the MGM, they were going to wait until the end of the Diaz fight and put on the Canelo fight. Now, the card went long, and I knew this was going to happen.
Of course.
Dana White talks about what happened shortly before the Diaz fight. He got a call from the folks at the MGM, and they're like, Mike, I'll let him explain it. Like, we need to calm this crowd down. We knew the start of this was going to be delayed, but they are freaking out right now.
The call said, you guys are halfway through your co-main event right now. We can't, people are losing their minds here or whatever. Can we show the Diaz fight at the MGM? And I was just like, holy, this is crazy. This is getting crazier by the minute. I woke up and dreamed all this. I wouldn't believe that it really, you know, that it could happen. But it was nuts. And of course, we said yes, and they did, and wow.
Yep, they showed it. And the reason that's significant and what Dana White is talking about there is there was such a war between, and really it wasn't even a war. It was a one-sided war. Boxing looked down their nose at MMA. This UFC stuff is crap. Now they're in the position, they're like, can we please run your fight? Because it's entertaining. We need to kill some time here. We don't want to go head-to-head with you guys. So I thought that was the biggest narrative coming out of the weekend. Next up.
Number four.
BJK playing tonight in Columbus. How you feeling right now about where they are? You got a tough road trip here, and the last two games were pretty strange.
Well, I'm feeling a little bit better as you look at the Golden Knights are up 1-0 on the Columbus Blue Jackets halfway through the second period. Riley Smith with a goal in the first period on his return back to Ohio. But no, listen, I mean, as I say, the Knights have an early lead. I'm sure there's some people out there that are cringing, right? That doesn't necessarily mean a good thing right now in Vegas Golden Knightland. And, yeah, I mean, there are some concerns. I mean, I understand we're only in a month into the season, whatever, 15% of the season through. But this is a team that is giving away leads, which is something they didn't do before, like flat out. And more specifically, they're giving up leads late in games. So they're not finishing. So that is a valid concern about a team that is not only, you know, battling some injuries here and there. Obviously, Alex Tuck going down his day-to-day with an upper body injury. And, you know, Nate Schmidt was out for a few games. And then Fleury had the flu. So they are plugging and playing a little bit. I understand that. But consistency is a little bit of an issue. And if they lose tonight in Columbus, you're looking at, okay, we'll count in the overtime losses. You're looking at a 500 team. And then you factor in the fact that this is the longest, I believe, road trip so far of the season against not just the Blue Jackets, but you got the Maple Leafs, Capitals, and Red Wings on the docket. That isn't necessarily a good feeling to come back to. So I think at other points, you know, specifically season one, when you look at some of the things they had to deal with, obviously they were burning and they were doing well. And then you look back to last year at the loss of Nate Schmidt. That was more what I would look at. Year two and the fact that they floundered under 500. And they were still able to, you know, bounce back. Now, you look back at the game seven against the San Jose Sharks, their ability not to get ahead early in the season cost them home ice in the playoffs, which game seven, maybe that goes a different way. But listen, I would say pump the brakes on some level as I'm sitting here being a little hyperbolic and a little worried. But the fact remains is if they don't, you know, put something together on this road trip and they come back under 500, the noise is going to mount. You know what I mean? And it's been comfortable sailing for the Knights for a couple of years, but you have a team that has been put together to win. They were the preseason favorites to come out of the Western Conference. You added Mark Stone and Max Pacioretty over the last season or so, and there comes expectations with that, so they're going to have to deal with it. And, you know, we'll see how they play in Columbus, because I'll say this about Columbus. They're up 1-0, 15 minutes left in the second period. This is a game that they need to win. You need to at least beat Columbus, and you probably need to take care of Detroit. Capitals and Maple Leafs, we'll see. But you need to come out of this split.
Top three stories.
Number three.
I feel like everyone in Ohio is kind of on edge, fired up, including this guy. Well, listen, Cleveland's very frustrated right now. They got a LeBron championship a couple of years back, but, man, the Browns are infuriating. Ryan McKinnell is not a fan of hot take hot shots. I want to see what you think and what the audience thinks of one Ken Carmen, the morning host on The Fan, in Cleveland, who was very, very angry that he chose the Browns as the right side in that game against the Broncos, and he came in just flipping mad.
As I said what I said, and it's my freaking fault for having any faith whatsoever in you. I should never, ever do it again. I should never have faith ever again. I should line up and be like the predecessors before me and be nasty and mean-spirited and angry over the entire thing every single time we watch out one of these quarterbacks that will hopefully take us from the hell that we have created for ourselves throughout this entire time and have us have this happen yet again. Because I made a guarantee that I'm personally responsible for. I have let myself down. I have let you down. I have let everybody down. So for the next 3 hours and 40 minutes, you got something to say to me, you go right on ahead. You will not get anything back from me. I got it coming to me because I'm a damn fool.
Is that Cleveland or Chicago? I can't tell.
It could have been New York radio this morning with the Giants. York. A lot of frustrated football cities out there.
That's not a hot take. That's emotion.
I was wondering. I didn't know if you were going to grade that as a genuine emotion or kind
of
fake.
Opposite of Joe Buck. That's passion. That's a care about sports. That is a man who is living in a city and living and breathing with his team, and he can't take it anymore. And I get it. I mean, I don't get it like a Cleveland Brown fan gets it. But, right. I mean, I have a taste of it. I understand what it's like to have expectations and then have those expectations ground into dust and put up just into the ethos and passed off into the air and to disappear like it never existed. And then also to be sitting in week 8 and know that you don't care about football. Yeah, no, I completely understand. I completely understand. Good for you, sir. Mm. Embrace the anger.
You know what's shocking?
What?
Young, fat, white host. Weird,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Well,
it's weird. Very angry.
We run hot.
Top two stories.
Four ways in one.
Number two.
Well, see, this is not good for Ohio. This is why they're very angry. I guess this is actually this is scientific. Science! A recent study names Columbus, let's go back to Columbus, the 7th most miserable city in the U.S. I don't know what the misery index included, but
you need to get out in the Midwest more. Columbus has Ohio State. I've partied in Columbus. Columbus is nuts.
I kind of liked Columbus.
Columbus is like Cancun for like all of fall and winter. Like Friday and Saturday, it's anarchy. It's chaos. No, Columbus is amazing. I can name like 15 other cities in the Midwest that have nothing, but Columbus has Ohio State, and that counts for a lot.
Columbus scored 62.3 on the index. What? Reports that only 21.9% of adults have a college degree. 27% of adults in the area are smokers.
Yeah, everyone leaves. That is true. Everyone who gets an education and goes to Ohio State goes off and gets better jobs. Yeah, I mean, if you're a townie in Columbus, I mean, I'm a townie from South Bend, so I fully understand the relationship.
Is Indiana more miserable than Ohio? And by the way, what's Fort Wayne like?
Well, okay. First, I'll address the first part. Depends on where you live in Indiana. Where I'm from in northwest Indiana, you're 80 miles away from Chicago. It's very easy. It's a very quick drive over to a big city, and it's fairly normal.
Do you drive up to Gary to hang out?
You drive through Gary. And I have hung out in Gary before, but that's many stories for not on local radio. We'll save that for Sirius. Fort Wayne is awesome. Fort Wayne is a strip club capital of the world. And they also have my favorite concert venue in Indiana, Pierre's, which is just a dive bar where great metal bands go. So I have nothing really bad to say about Fort Wayne. I will say this about Indiana. I did kind of have a credo living in Indiana that you could cut everything south off of Fort Wayne and I wouldn't miss it. So that's kind of my feelings on Indiana. I kind of end Indiana with Fort Wayne.
And this isn't just, you know, Midwest bashing list, because I'm looking at the top 50. There's plenty of California cities in there, including Lancaster, California.
Sure.
Redding,
sure.
California. Hemet. I've been through Hemet.
That's how many Indiana towns were on that list?
Let's see. Anderson, Hammond.
Anderson.
And actually number one on the list, at least this one according to Business Insider, actually is Gary.
Yeah, it has to be. And a Hammond is basically Gary, so I don't know why you really count Hammond and
Gary.
Ah,
come on!
No, it's like 15 miles away from each other.
You know what I was saying, ah, come on, too.
What? I actually don't.
Yeah, Plainfield, New Jersey. West New York, New Jersey. Patterson, New Jersey. Trenton, New Jersey. Union City, New Jersey.
We should have a
New
battle.
New Brunswick. Come on!
We should have a
Camden,
battle.
New Jersey. Newark, New Jersey. Passaic. Wow, they all made it.
Well, that speaks volumes to where we're from and why we carry so much anger with us. And also, how appreciative we are to land in Las Vegas to be a part of this wonderful city. Thank you, Las Vegas.
Do you ever want to go back and live there? Did you hear what I just read?
What, a snort
it's
arsenic?
Like, it's like 10 of the top 50 most miserable cities in the country. Number one.
Number one.
Swim with alligators?
I don't know about London. Would London be a good spot where I would live mostly full-time if I were playing in the NFL? The London Chargers, floated by Vinny B of The Athletic, was not greeted with open arms by Chargers ownership.
You think?
I actually think it's an intriguing idea. What do you think?
I love London. I love the people. I love the city. My dad was born there. I don't want to see NFL in London.
Okay, let's say they're going to London with a team.
Yeah. Then, well.
If they're going to London with a team, should the Chargers consider being in the mix? It would not be fun for players in the short term. The travel would be miserable. We'll get to divisional realignment. That would be interesting. Because let's deal with reality here. How long is it going to take the Chargers to really build up a fan base in Los Angeles?
A long time.
When they haven't been there. The NFL wasn't in L.A. for 20 to 25 years, so there's a whole group of whatever ages you want to go with, you know, 12 to, like, 30 years old who don't care about the NFL. Is L.A., as the second team, a less attractive option versus London?
How long will it take in London, I guess, would be the flip side of that. But I think there's a few issues here. Number one, I mean, scheduling is going to be a nightmare. You'd essentially have to have, like, maybe your first three games on the road, and then everything else would have to be coming off a bye when people – you have to do, like, 6 weeks of home games. I don't know how it would work in regards to that. I question how football would carry on there, and I also question what that move would do to football domestically. When everyone's hand-wringing and everyone's worried about teams moving and loyalty, I mean, that's a directory. This is, like – it's great that it involves the Chargers because the Chargers are kind of like the symbolism of that right now. And I think it hurt them that they only moved, what, 60 miles north because it's like – I don't know. It's like your girlfriend cheats on you, and then she moves in with your next-door neighbor. It's just like you have to watch it every day. You have to live with it. You have to see it. You have to hear about it. It has to be like almost like right there that you can touch it. It's just a nightmare, right? So in that sense, moving to London is great for San Diego because you can fully be done with the Chargers. Mm-hmm. You can just say, you know what, blow it up. I don't care. Go Raiders. I'm going to Vegas. I don't know what your response to that would be. Maybe you're done with football. I really don't know. Are you smelling the chicken?
I'm smelling chicken
fingers.
Yeah,
I smell the chicken fingers.
Dean Spanos on this said it's total – blanking BS, okay, we're not going to London, we're not going anywhere, we're playing in Los Angeles, this is our home, this is where I'm planning to be for a long effing time, period. Is it really Dean Spanos who gets to decide?
No, and you know...
I'll throw in, just right. To be super cheesy, I don't know if you... Did you watch All the Ballers?
No. I don't
Hey, Dean, you have less power than The Rock as the sort of owner of the Chiefs.
Okay.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Now here, this is the saving grace, because I don't believe Dean Spanos has any power. If the NFL wanted to and the other owners wanted to tell him, because they already told him once. They had a joint stadium project in Carson, not in Carson, and I'm blanking on where now, with the Raiders, right? They thought they were getting that. And then the NFL's like, nope, Rams get it, and you can share the Rams stadium, but your stadium plan that you had going, that's kaput. Here's the saving grace for Dean Spanos. You know who will not let the Chargers go to London?
Shad Khan?
No, the guy who already flexed his muscle and screwed over the Chargers in a way, but definitely screwed over the Raiders, Stan Kroenke. Because Stan Kroenke's like, wait a second, I'm building like a $5 billion complex. The game plan is to make money off the Chargers. You're not taking the Chargers from me. And if Stan Kroenke says something, like, you know, I don't think he says a lot behind the scenes, but when he says something, everyone in the league, including Jerry Jones, is like, okay, sir. So this won't happen. But, you know, it shows that it's been discussed. Believe me.
Those reports don't get out without legs.
He didn't make this up.
Right.
They've been discussing it. I'm sure there's been ongoing discussions about what team could move to London. But it shines a light on the bigger problem. The Chargers are not going to be able to draw in that stadium for like 10 years. And what I'm saying is they'll have some games where they fill 80,000 plus, but I think most games are going to be like 50 or 55,000. That's not the goal.
It's going to be all Pittsburgh or Chicago fans.
Right, you're going to have a lot of road fans.
Yep.
Why can't the NFL just do what it should have done in the first place? Your revenue every year is like $16 to $18 billion. Can you just give a loan? And hell, you know what? Just throw like $500 million at them. Just build a freaking stadium in San Diego.
And stop making.
That's where they should be, right. And build it. And here's the other thing. Waive your stupid limit on Super Bowl crowd, whatever, capacity, you know, eligibility capacity. Build like a 50, 55,000 seat stadium. Build it on the freaking Qualcomm site. You know, that San Diego State's already planning on, you know, getting their thing done there. Or do it down in the gas lamp. That's where they should be. You make so much money. It's a good market. Put them back there.
Plus, look what you're doing to these markets, Steve. St. Louis, Los Angeles, the list goes on.
Yep.
You're ripping their hearts out. And then you're making them be hesitant about anything you bring back, anything that comes in. Do we care? How do you give something like you gave? If you're an actual Chargers fan, I can't imagine that. I remember when the White Sox were talking about moving to Florida in the 90s. Like, yep. I can't even fathom.
Oh, all that stadium stuff completely wore out the Charger fans. And then they got an unfair rap the last, you know, couple of years they were there. People were like, well, they're not even showing up.
Yeah, of course they're not.
Because they're pissed.
Right.
They're hurt. They're broken. One last thing that would be really – let's just talk London in general. This is like a sports talk topic if I'm still alive in, whatever, 4 years. If there's a team there in 2023 –
Give yourself quite the leash there.
Well, if there's – I know. Very hopeful. If there's a team in 2023 and they started talking about realignment with divisions, because they'd have to, right? Especially if it were a – it doesn't matter who it is. If it's Jacks or if it were the Chargers, in all likelihood, they'd have to be in probably – the AFC East. How do you think the Patriots and Bill Belichick would react to having to go and freaking drag his team to London?
Well, you're talking about Kroenke's influence. Now, I wonder how far Kraft's influence would
right?
go on that. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be hilarious? Or will we get something ridiculous? I saw people suggesting, LA Chargers moved to London, they'd be in the AFC South.
No.
What?
No,
they're in the AFC East? That's just the way it is.
100%.
Sorry, Belichick.
And also,
sorry, Jets.
When does this
sorry,
end?
Dolphins.
When does this end? When a new Jacksonville Jaguar comes along, or when a new Charger comes along? And was it going to be Paris? Is it going to be?
No. Because
London. I understand.
They've been planning for London forever.
But what's stopping them from continuing that world domination? Nothing. That's what they want. Mexico City. They want London. They want Toronto. They want Paris. They want something.
Toronto's an option. Mexico City is not. And
really?
Paris is not.
Why don't you think Mexico City is an option?
I don't think they would draw for every game. I think it would also be – I was going to break up elevation, but obviously Denver is super elevation too.
I'd rather travel to Mexico City than travel across the Atlantic Ocean to London.
Can we just say it straight out? There's more money in London.
Yeah.
They've already proven that they can support 3-4 games a year versus Mexico City.
Yeah.
All right, on the way back, we're going to check in on the Raiders. Former Raider, former NFL player, Stanford Rout is up on Cofield & Company.
It's the Big 5 at 5, brought to you by Battle Born Injury Lawyers. If you've been injured, call Justin Watkins at Battle Born Injury Lawyers, 570-9000.
Here's the toss, Jacobs. Cut back, goes end zone, dives to the end zone for a Raider touchdown. And now he vaults into the black hole for the celebration.
Now, back to Cofield & Company. Live at the Thomas and Mack.
Running Rebel basketball on the way at 7 o'clock. We'll hand it off to Running Rebel warm-up at 6:30. Every Tuesday at this time, we get into the Raiders. NFL insider, former NFL player, former Raider, Stanford Rout, is on the horn. How you doing, buddy? I think he's there. Maybe he didn't like me calling him buddy. He's like, I'm not your buddy.
I'm not your buddy, friend. Think of that South Park gimmick. I'm not your friend, guy. I'm not your guy, buddy. Oh, sorry. If you saw that, it's funny. If you didn't, I'm an idiot.
Stanford.
Yes, sir.
What's up, man? How are you?
What's going on, guys? Happy to be back on.
What's up, Stanford? Glad to have you. You know what? I did not expect the Raiders to be sitting here right now at the halfway point for them at 4-4, and I thought a lot of it on Sunday and the last couple of weeks has been the work of the offensive line. Pretty courageous stuff considering all the injuries.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think that in life and oftentimes in sports, it's great when you see people go from being counted out to counted on. And I think so many people counted the Raiders out after Antonio Brown's departure, this, that, and the other. So for them to be able to band together and then to be sitting at 4-4, a possibility of going up 5-4 after Thursday night's game against the Los Angeles Chargers, I think it's a great opportunity for them and a great position to be in.
And think about what's happened with the O-line. It's played this well. Rodney Hudson has been in and out. Obviously, they've had issues at guard with major injuries and also the suspension with Incognito. Trent Brown is now struggling with injuries, but they've had guys step up. I thought Andre James did a really good job at center over the weekend. I also, you know what, not that the D-line has been terrible all year, but it's been one of the more underachieving units. I thought the defensive line, and there's a lot of no-names on that line, but I thought they were really huge down the stretch against Matt Stafford and that Lions offense.
Yeah, I think so, too, and that's what games are won and lost. They're won and lost in the trenches. Obviously, the backs and receivers, the DBs, the guys on the edges, they're probably the ones who probably get more of the pub, get more of the acclaim when it comes to all of the networks and the commercial and things like that. But games are won and lost in the trenches. And you can even go and look on the offensive line for the Oakland Raiders to see they had 171 rushing yards as a team. Josh Jacobs had 120 on the ground. That just goes to show that they're being able to control the clock, control the flow of the game, and whenever you're able to do that, you're able to sustain drive and be able to churn out victories.
Do you like what you're seeing in terms of growth this year from Derek Carr? I thought he pushed the ball down the field a little bit more, and that's really been, if you were going to criticize him this season, that would be the one weakness. I think he's getting a little more confidence in some of his weapons and making sure that he gets it down the field.
Yeah, he definitely is. I believe he had, what was it, 2 touchdowns, 0 interceptions, 20-31, so around 2/3, 66% completion percentage, still leading the league in completion percentage throughout the year. I think that he is starting to gain more confidence, and he's starting to feel like he was back in that 2016 season when they went 12-4. He's starting to feel some of that magic, and I think that with him and John Gruden growing together, starting to become a little bit more cohesive, where they're starting to understand one another, I think the big things are to come because, like you just said, nobody expected them to be 4-4. Everybody expected the Raiders to be a dumpster fire right now, and they're right there in the thick of things. And if it wasn't for Deshaun Watson simply being phenomenal, they'd be sitting right now at 5-3 instead of 4-4. But once again, they got the Los Angeles Chargers on Thursday, and they've already started off the first half of the season 500. So now they got to go ahead, take the next step, and I still don't see any reason why this team cannot sneak into the playoffs.
Let's talk about the roster a little bit. This is kind of a bummer. Brandon Marshall is actually a local guy, went to Cimarron High School here in Las Vegas. I guess this is the life of the fringe guy trying to make it back from injuries. They brought him in on Friday, and by Monday, he's gone.
Yeah, that's unfortunately the way that this league works. Whenever you're not necessarily a marquee guy, whenever you're not somebody who is a bona fide starter at that point in time in your career, it does get to the point where it's a little bit of kind of like a swinging door, kind of like, you know, next guy up, here today, gone tomorrow type of dynamic. So the main thing is you got to maintain your focus, and you got to be ready to just roll with the punches, because just like on any team, there's going to be ups and downs in the season. There's going to be ups and downs in life, and you got to persevere, because no matter where you are in your career, things can always turn around. It's just a phone call, somebody getting injured, and your next guy up, and a few positive plays going back the other direction can really change your career and turn everything back around to where it once was.
Stanford Routes with us, former Raider, former NFL player. Do most players hate Thursday night football? John Gruden does. He said, I hate this. I don't believe in this Thursday night football.
I tell you guys, for me being a corner, and obviously in the back end, we don't really have to come up and tackle as much playing the trenches like the big guys. It was something that never really bothered me because I wasn't somebody that was always in the trenches hitting. Now, if I'm somebody that's over there doing the dirty work, I would despise playing on Thursday night, because you play the game on Sunday afternoon. Sunday night, you go ahead, maybe get in a little hot tub, in the cold tub, something like that. Monday, you try to go and get all the kinks out, maybe get a lift in. You watch the film after the game. Tuesday, you're off. Wednesday's the start of the work week. And there's a lot of guys that their body's not ready to practice until Friday leading into the game on Sunday. So you're asking these world-class athletes to go play a game on Sunday, and God forbid it be an away game when you play on that Thursday night. God forbid it's an away game where you got to actually travel, let's say, 1 to 2 time zones, or even 3 time zones for that matter. It's very difficult to get your body back to where it needs to be at optimum level. So I definitely understand a lot of the players' sentiment of despising Thursday night football, because you get so much of a watered-down product. Because if you got an all-pro Mike linebacker, or you got some nose guard who's been in the Pro Bowl the last 3 or 4 seasons, he's not going to be able to give you what he's able to give you every Sunday afternoon, because his body's not where it needs to be. So I think that you get a little bit less of a product, and that's why you start to see games on Thursday night football, especially when it's a divisional matchup with, let's say, the Tennessee Titans and the Jacksonville Jaguars. You don't get those marquee matchups where you see both teams really firing off all cylinders. You get a little bit of the water down. Now, the NFL has done a better job of actually making marquee matchups, Packers and Eagles, or you see the Rams and the Seahawks. They've done a better job of that, but historically over the years, it's always been a little bit of a dud of a game on Thursday night. I like how they're improving the pairing this season on Thursday night football with it being on Fox, but as a player, that's something that you necessarily aren't jumping up and down whenever you get the schedule in April and you start to see that you have a Thursday night game. You're not excited about that, not by any stretch of the imagination.
Tell me if I need to pump the brakes on this. I think through 11 games, this team could be 7-4. Through 14, they could be 9-5. They could also not be anywhere close to that, but here's what's coming up. Chargers is Thursday, at Jets, home Bengals, at Chiefs, home Titans, home Jaguars. What's realistic through 14? Is 9-5 too much?
I don't think that 9-5 is something that is infeasible. I don't think so. I think that it definitely is doable. Is it going to be easy? No, it's not going to be easy, because no game on any NFL schedule against any team is going to be just a cakewalk. But everything that you just mentioned, the Chargers, yes, they can beat the Chargers. They obviously, we see that the Los Angeles Chargers played a really good game against Green Bay just a couple of days ago. But once again, divisional rivalry. The Raiders are always able to play the Chargers tough, even back when I was there. So I don't see any reason why they can't win that game. I believe next after that is the New York Jets. I believe they should be able to beat the New York Jets.
Oh, come on now. Let's be more demanding. They have to beat the Jets and the Bengals. Those are must. You can't lose those games.
No, you can't lose those games. But like I said, yeah. I've learned in this league, you don't want to walk into a game just knowing, okay, you know what, we're the better team, so we're automatically going to win, because it doesn't always work like that. We looked at the Baltimore Ravens and the New England Patriots. I thought the New England Patriots were going to win that game by 2 scores. And clearly we see that Baltimore went in there and they showed everybody, you know what, this is our home turf. We're going to go ahead and play the best of our ability. And they went ahead to New England their first loss of the season. So I do believe that the Texans will beat – I'm sorry, not the Texans, the Raiders will beat the Jets, and they'll beat the Bengals. The Chiefs, that's going to be a tough game, and it's going to be an Arrowhead. So I could very easily see the Raiders losing that game, whether it's Pat Mahomes or Matt Moore at the quarterback position. And then I think that when you really go down the list, I don't see any reason why they cannot be 9-5 after 14 games.
Let's close on a general NFL topic with Stanford Rout here on this Tuesday. Comes out earlier today, Cam Newton on IR. He's done for the season. Does there need to be like an angry angle on this? Or is this just the way it goes sometimes with a guy like Cam Newton, who has taken, you know, a lot of abuse because, you know, they needed him to run the ball at times? Should we be angry about Cam being done for the season and maybe at a, you know, a serious crossroads here?
In what context, when you say should we be angry at Cam being done for the season?
Well, not at Cam. We played some audio earlier from former teammate D'Angelo Williams, and he said he was really annoyed that now they've got Kyle Allen, just, you know, kind of a drop back guy, handing the ball off to Christian McCaffrey. They don't ask him to go out and take a beating. I guess he's angry that they never just use Cam as a pocket quarterback.
I think that that's a little bit disingenuous by D'Angelo Williams, simply because the reason why they didn't ask Cam to be a drop back passer is because I don't think that's what Cam's best is. Even looking back at Auburn, Cam is a dual threat guy. And anytime you see a guy who is a dual threat, he probably is going to be a better runner than a passer. Now, Deshaun Watson, a guy that we got down here in Houston, Texas, for the Texans. I think he's a phenomenal player because he's somebody who is mobile. He can run, but he's truly a pocket passer underneath it all. And I think with Cam Newton, he's the direct antithesis of that, simply because Cam has always been a runner. And I think because Cam has always been a transformer out there on the football field, 6'5", 250, can run a 4.4, just like a supreme athlete. Because of that, I have always been led to believe, from what I see, that Cam has never taken the time to truly harness all of his ability and truly work on his craft of being a precision passer. That's why you see Carolina is always up and down. We look, go back to the MVP season. They went, 15-1 back in 2015. And guess what? Cam Newton, even his stats back then, aside from the total touchdown, when you add up rushing and passing, Cam Newton was not the best quarterback in the NFL that year, by no stretch. But guess what? He had a really good run game. He had a really good defense. But when you look at Cam Newton just in a vacuum and you rate him as a quarterback, not somebody who's a running quarterback but also passes, when you evaluate him off the true essence of the position, he is somebody that has never really excelled at being a precision passer, somebody that can read defenses, somebody that can anticipate when windows are going to open. And that's why you've always noticed the Carolina Panthers doing a lot of the zone read, doing a lot of the read option, doing a lot of the RPO, because the better quarterback, Tom Brady, Drew Brees, I'll still put Phillip Rivers up in there, Ben Roethlisberger, you look at Deshaun Watson, Pat Mahomes, let's go ahead and look at Seattle with Russell Wilson. You notice those upper echelon quarterbacks, and I can't forget my man Aaron Rodgers, those upper echelon quarterbacks, you don't see as much of the RPO, the zone read type of action. They simply are in the shotgun, they get up under center, play action fake, they turn around, they're facing the defense, and they throw that ball on target, over the linebacker, under the safety, and they can do that over and over and over and over and over again. And I think that's right there, to me, the true essence of the quarterback position. And so because of Cam Newton not being able to master that is one of the main reasons why they always asked him to run. But Kyle Allen seems like he is better equipped for Norv Turner's offense, because Norv Turner was my coach my rookie year in Oakland. And I think that's why you see the juncture that they're at right now in Charlotte.
Stanford, you're awesome. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. Thank you.
Appreciate you guys.
Yeah, that was real good. Real good. Cam Newton that year, the 15-1 year, it's a pretty incredible year. Yeah. Threw for 38, 37. He had 35 touchdowns against just 10 interceptions. He rushed for 636 and 10 more touchdowns. He was responsible for 45 touchdowns. But to Stanford's point, he still wasn't precise. The completion percentage under 60%. You actually wonder how much that year took off potentially the end of his career, because he carried the ball 132 times for a quarterback in 16 games. So you're looking at 8 or 9 carries alone from the quarterback position. Man, I don't understand people at all. We got more than a few cases of utter confusion coming up in the grab bag.
Join the conversation on Twitter at Cofield & Co. Cofield & Company presents...
Hey, hold on. Bag up.
Grab bag.
Don't touch it. Don't even look at it.
Only on ESPN Las Vegas.
Stick your hand in there, Dave.
Basketball expert Mike Romala coming up here in less than 10. He and McKinnell will carry it up until 6:30 before a running Rebel warm-up. 7 o'clock tip. We're at the Thomas & Mack. 13th year of Cofield & Company out here leading into the games. That's pretty cool.
Will he make 20? Tune in to find out.
We'll see.
Might be dead.
We'll see. Maybe be in a different time slot down the road. You never know what happens.
Ooh.
In radio. Back in there.
Stick your hand in there, Dave.
All right. I know I bag on Patriots fans a lot.
No, you should on this case.
First of all, let's go back to Sunday. We played this highlight yesterday. I just want you to hear the Patriots analyst, Scott Zolak, just go full baby mode. The Patriots have almost – Patriots – and the Patriots fans, right? And the Patriots broadcasters have almost nothing to complain about. They have so few low points. The Ravens are smacking them around early in the game, and listen to Zolak.
To the left wing. Edwards behind Jackson, who fakes it and runs it to the left. Jackson is going to trot into the end zone.
showboating with a high step for a Baltimore touchdown.
Jerome Fall right there, freebie. Little showboat right there. Keep that in your memoir. Just remember that. Next time you get a shot at him, take the shot.
What do you think of that? Take the shot. We don't give up touchdowns ever. We're mad. Now, this is even better. We found a video of a Patriots fan on the road in Baltimore. What do you think the kid is? Is he a teenager? Is he early 20s?
19. I think that's safe, 19, 20.
Think about it. If you are a 20-year-old Patriots fan, what an amazing existence you've had! He's crying.
Weeping.
His eyes are all welled up.
And you can't hear
tears.
It, but the audio, I guarantee you, is the... Like the catching of the breath, like you can see it. It is pathetic.
I love sports, and I get really mad. And you know what? I'll say as a young kid, I probably shed a tear over a game or two. But my God.
When you win
all the time.
That'd be like you as a Yankees fan crying when you got out of the playoffs this year in the ALCS. It would be the exact same thing. Now, actually, it would be worse, or it would be more understandable for you because it's been, you know, almost two decades. So you kind of understand that. Now, this, and listen, you said you cried when you were a little kid. I don't believe that. I think you're like me, where we internalize, we don't cry, we just get very angry. Like, I've ripped shirts. I've done horrible things. Like, I've been very angry, but I don't get emotional like that. I just work on a heart attack.
I was talking about, like, 11 years old that I did that. Believe me, by the time, especially with the Jets, that I was, like, 17, 18, 20, I was hitting stuff.
Yeah.
Screaming at the top of my lungs outside. Yeah,
all that. Cold silences for 24 hours on end. People checking on you. After that Bears Colts Super Bowl, my stepdad literally came to me like on day three and was like, "Are you going to be okay?" Like he was legit concerned about me, and that's sports.
Grab Bag today brought to you by our friends at Born and Raised in Las Vegas and Henderson. Two happy hours. One is ending right now, but another one is on the way. 3 to 6 and then midnight to 6 a.m. They've got 350 beers, 450 well drinks during happy hour. McKinnell will be all over this to get an order of sliders for just $6, or the bar bites like Texas-style nachos, or the Anchor Fries. The original location is on Warm Springs between Buffalo and Durango. Bar Henderson is right there at St. Rose and Eastern. And you want to download the Bar Fam app. For every 100 you spend, you get $5 back. So get in there to either spot locally, and there's one on the Strip as well. Born and raised in Las Vegas and Henderson.
Visit Cofield's Corner on LVSportsNetwork.com for access to the latest podcasts and best interviews. Now, back to Cofield and Company, live at the Thomas and Mack.
All right, we go overtime. Cofield and Company, you heard it, Thomas and Mack. UNLV basketball season opens tonight. Purdue Fort Wayne is in town. We'll find out from Mike Romala what the Mastodons are all about. Big Mac is here as well. We have to mention a food topic real quickly. Remember, Tuesdays, Thomas and Mac. Romala, you know about this?
I heard about it earlier today.
$2 tacos. $2 tacos.
Wait, I'm sorry. This starts tonight?
Yes. Every Tuesday at home, $2 tacos.
Do they take credit card?
Yes, of course.
I'm very hungry.
I don't think they have a cash-only concession.
That's true. I spent a weekend out at the concert at that Day in Vegas thing, so I'm paranoid now. I saw this food that I wanted.
Do you need money? Because I need someone to try the tacos.
I have a question.
Yes.
Yes.
How much does a taco normally cost?
How good? Donald Trump?
I've never had – how much – Is $2 a great deal on a taco?
It's a pretty solid deal, I would say, at an arena.
Is it like $6 for a regular taco?
You could go to some arenas and stadiums where they could be $8. So okay. I think it's a pretty good deal. $2 taco Tuesday.
So it's sort of the equivalent of like a hot dog, like in that $8-$9 range at a ball game.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like
it's a deal.
Okay.
It's a deal.
Okay.
And three tacos for $6. I think you're pretty full. I think you're good to go. So, Gramala sits down. Gramala, of course, the Rebel expert from the Las Vegas Sun. And McKinnell's like, "Have you had the Popeye's chicken sandwich?" And I'm like, "What? This is lunacy." He has not had it.
I know, but that's. Maybe he surprises me.
Yeah, you know what? It is worth asking.
Yeah,
you're not even a chicken guy.
I would eat that. I eat chicken. I eat Raising Cane's, KFC, like fried chicken. I make chicken at home.
Okay.
Had the Chick-fil-A sandwich.
Yeah, I've had the Chick-fil-A
He's
sandwich.
A fan.
I'll eat, but just plain. I won't put any sauce or anything
on
it.
So weird.
But
it's a little weird.
I've just never been a fan of Popeyes.
We're gonna break in Mike a little more, because Mike and I oftentimes will cross paths on the road around UNLV, and we were up at Colorado State. Actually, Mike was nice enough to share a rental car. Right, I got a ride up from Denver, so that was cool. I owe you money. And I made a whole list of places like, hey, I'm in Fort Collins. Like, it's like a big brew pub town. I don't know. They're hearty meat eaters. So let's do this. And I found a couple cool places. And Mike's like, I think there's Outback around, so probably gonna hit that. He wound up hitting a burger place, but you love Outback.
I do.
We have to get you an Outback deal.
You know what? I had a buddy once said, very much like you, Mike, and I questioned him about his choices for chains, and he said, listen, Big Mac, it wouldn't be a chain if it wasn't amazing.
Is that right?
They have to make more of them. It's a universal fun flavor for everybody.
Well, I guess it can generally be a safe choice when you go on the road. You are taking a little risk by going to local restaurants, but it's worth the risk. It's worth the risk.
And I'm not opposed to trying like local restaurants and things like that. It's just I'm going to get the same thing there that I would get at like a regular burger.
You're not going to be an adventurous eater anyway.
Yeah, it's going to be a burger or it's going to be chicken.
Not big on farm to table. Not big on the ingredients.
Just a burger. Just give me the burger or a pizza or whatever. I'm not ordering anything that's... I'm not sampling, like, the local cuisine, like, stuff that you can only get in Colorado. I'm not having the oysters. I'm not doing any of that, you know?
You realize this is, like, the whole reason I travel, right? Like, my vacations, yeah, like, completely revolve around what local place I'm going to try and really what place I'm going to drive to then try.
Yeah, no, a lot of people do that. I understand it. It's cool. But I just like, for me, it's the exact opposite. I just don't want the anxiety of like having to look at these restaurant menus online, like before I go there and see what they have. And just
too many decisions.
Open up the phone, find the nearest Outback. Give me that chicken on the Barbie. Let's go. We're ready to go.
We got a couple of Mountain West games that have started. Fresno's in Oregon. That's a 2-2 start very early on. And Idaho State is at Wyoming. Man, I don't think Wyoming's going to be very good, but they were favored in that one by 7.5. Just starting Colorado State and Denver. Boise State is playing someone I don't know. It's like Life Pacific. Utah State, Montana State, 7 o'clock. This game at 7 o'clock. Texas Southern getting 15 against San Diego State. And then the nightcap, Reno. That one's down a half point. Reno will take on Utah. That one's on CBS Sports Network. So, what do we know about Purdue, Fort Wayne? We know the coach has been around a while. I don't think he's ever had a losing season at that school. And he's certainly familiar to T.J. Altenberger.
Yeah, it's a good Summit League program. Like, they're a winning team. I don't think they've finished lower than fourth under this coach. And it's a team that sort of, if it doesn't mirror T.J. Altenberger's style, it's sort of in a similar vein. They're going to push the ball a lot. They're in the top 30 or so for adjusted tempo. They play really fast. They shoot a lot of three-pointers. It's that style that's sort of taking over basketball, that modern, you know, let's push the ball up, take the first open three-pointer we can get. So that's what, if you're looking for a game that's going to show you T.J. Altenberger's vision for what he wants basketball to look like at UNLV, like, this is a good game because both teams are going to be playing that style. No one's going to be trying to slow it down and muck it up. Probably just going to get two teams racing up and down the court playing that quick, fast-break basketball.
And this team got South Dakota State a year ago at least one time. I think they beat them 105-81 in one of the games. So, like you said, they can score. I know in that game they went 9-29, which is not great, but had 9 three-pointers. So, familiar foe. In terms of personnel, what are we looking at?
They've got a couple returning players back. They lost, you know, their all-time leading scorer who graduated. Leaves a bit of a hole in the backcourt, but they've got a couple nice forwards that are good. Matt Holba is their leading returning scorer. He's, you know, 12 points a game, 5 rebounds. They got a couple shooters coming back. They've got a transfer coming in from Kansas State that they're reading the local media. Brian Patrick, someone that they're excited about, another shooter. So it's one of those teams that's just built around shooting. They're adding more shooting. That's what they want to be. One of those teams, if they come in and shoot 45% from three, it's going to be tough to beat them. So it's by no means a gimme, even though they're not, you know, highly regarded at this point in the season. They're low ranked in most of these preseason rankings. They're a team that can come in and give you problems.
It's Mike Romala. Ryan McKinnell's here. It's Cofield. We're about 23 minutes away from handing it off to Running Rebel warm-up with John and Curtis Terry. So let's introduce. Now, I know for hardcore Rebels fans, this may be a little bit annoying, but, you know, a lot of people in this market don't know all the players on this team. There's a lot of newcomers. There weren't many people here at the exhibition. It was not televised, so we'll get into that in a little bit. But let's run down the roster, right? Let's talk about the roster, some of the holdovers, but especially some of the newcomers. And with the holdovers, I want to hear Mike's opinion on what the role is going to be this year, because I think it's different than for some of the guys than it was a year ago. But let's talk about guys at the top of the roster. Let's start with Donnie Tillman, position, what his role is going to be, and what you think his skill set is.
He's the guy that sort of was the linchpin of this first recruiting class for TJ Otzelberger, just because the system fit is so good. He's like a 6'6", 6'7", guy who can play both forward spots. But with Otzelberger, you probably want to see him at power forward. Good, solid defender. He'll rebound hard. He plays really, really hard. And the biggest thing is he can shoot threes. So he gives you a power forward who can step out to both corners. He can step out to the wings. And he can hit three-pointers at, you know, 38, 39% last year. That's a guy who is going to be very valuable. He's someone that he's going to be on the floor all the time just because he's so matchup resistant. Like, he can play in pretty much any style. No matter what the opposing team is doing, Otzelberger can sort of use him to read and react. And you pick the right guy to start with, because he's sort of the key to the style that they want to play and how Otzelberger's offense is going to work.
What type of, I guess, win improvement does a guy like Donnie Tillman add to a team like this? Because, I mean, obviously he does have, I guess, not a mountain to climb in front of him, but it's a bit of a project, but he's a really good player, and I know people are high on him. So what exactly does he add?
In terms of, is he going to make them a winning team?
Yep. Like, in terms of, would you put the number of wins he adds to this specific Runnin' Rebel basketball team?
If they didn't have him, they're probably a sub 500 team for the year.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, 13, 14 wins. With him, you know, you can win 16, 17, 18 games if you have a good year. He does that much. He filled a big hole. If they didn't get him in the offseason, you'd be seeing Nick Blair playing that similar role. And Nick Blair, he's a solid player. He's good for what he is, a former walk-on who's now a fifth-year senior, and he gives you some things, but he can't do what Donnie Tillman can do. So the drop-off from Tillman to Blair would have been probably at least a few games, I would think.
Well, you talk about Nick Blair, and obviously the veteran on the team, he brings a lot of that to the locker room, obviously. What is his role going to be in this season? Because as you kind of mentioned, I imagine there's going to be some changes for him a little bit.
He's not going to be as detrimentally affected as some other players, because he can still shoot pretty well for his position.
Yeah.
He shot better last year as the year went on. Blair, I think he ended up around 33%, but in conference play, he was a better three-point shooter. Just because he's so, you know, he's burly and he's athletic, he's another guy, he can play the three or the four. So when Tillman's not on the floor, Blair is probably going to be on the floor. In the exhibition, we saw them playing together. As long as he can shoot, as long as he makes his three-pointers, that's what T.J. Otzelberger said about him over the summer. He said, I like Nick Blair. That's why I re-recruited him. I wanted him to be on the team, but I want him to shoot better. Like, I want to see him at 40% three-point shooting. And if he does that, he'll play a lot. He'll play 20 minutes a game, and he'll be like he's probably going to be your sixth or seventh man, depending on what they do with Amari Hardy. But a big role, as long as he makes those shots.
Well, you brought up the exhibition game. Now, I think there's a lot of people out there who didn't get to see it, didn't exactly know why people were so excited. I mean, it was a clear butt-kicking against the team, though, you know, Cofield kind of touched on it. A not very, lack of a better term, sexy team, right? But what did you think about that exhibition and what we saw very briefly, right, from TJO?
Yeah, you can't take a whole lot from, you know, the West Coast Baptist College. They were, you know, it's just not a real team, but what you can see is the shooting was probably my biggest takeaway, and it wasn't a good takeaway, because, you know, Joni Antonio was on point, like 7 of 11 from the three-point line, and we know he's a good shooter. The rest of the team, 2 of 12, which is not good, and that's the big question mark. You know, Amari Hardy, he had an improvement as a three-point shooter last year, but was that real, or was that, you know, a hot streak? Bryce Hamilton is not known as an outside shooter. Elijah Mitchell Long struggled with his shot last year. So these guys that are going to be taking all these three-pointers we expect them to take, we expect UNLV to shoot 750 threes this year. That's a lot. The guys that are going to be shooting them do not have a long track record of being good shooters. So that's the biggest question. And they were open against, you know, West Coast Baptist College. I mean, any shot you take against that team is basically an open team, because they're so small, you just shoot right over them. and they still didn't hit at a very good percentage. So that's something we have to see. That was probably my biggest takeaway from that exhibition.
All right, well, you brought up Amari Hardy. We talk about roles on this team. His role is going to be changing a little bit. What do you think? You know, the system isn't exactly conducive, right, to his style of play. But, I mean, this is a really good basketball we're playing, or we're talking about, excuse me. So how do you see him fitting in?
He's going to be a very important piece. All offseason, you know, everyone, you know, assumed that he was the biggest guy that they had to re-recruit when he put his name in the transfer portal. It was a big deal when he recommitted to UNLV. And I think, you know, the thing with Amari is you saw him have a breakout year last year as a sophomore, and you saw all the things that he's good at, but the things that he's not great at are the things that T.J. Otzelberger needs him to do.
Right.
So it's a fit thing where Amari Hardy is really great if you put the ball in his hands, give him a screen, let him dribble the ball six or seven times, let him make a little spin move, let him make a hesitation move. He can get to the basket and hit those floaters and those layups. But T.J. Otzelberger doesn't want people dribbling for 6 seconds. He doesn't want you doing that. He wants you to catch it and immediately pass it or immediately drive it. And Amari's just, he's been playing this way for so long where it's, you know, catch the ball, survey the defense, stand there, take it in,
Is he capable of adjusting, and does he need to?
Yeah, you are. He is. He's still a young guy. Like, there's no,
right.
There's no habit that can't be broken at this point. It's just how much does he want to buy in? That's the question. If he buys in completely and says, you know, yes, sir, coach, I'll do exactly what you want. I'm going to make mistakes sometimes just because that's my muscle memory, and I've been playing this style for my entire life, so I'm going to slip up at times, but I'm really committed to changing my game and fitting the system. You know, then there's no problems. You work with him, and by the end of the year, he'll be fine. If he's sort of resistant to that, which a lot of players are, you try and buck this as you say, well, I'm gonna wave off this play and I'm gonna do my own thing. And if I score, it's all gonna be good. The problem is with T.J. Otzelberger, it's not gonna be good. Even if you score, he gives me the sense that he's one of those guys like, he's still going to yank you if you do it the wrong way and score because
right.
You did it the wrong way. So there's a chance that there's some butting of the heads between those two players because Amori is such a key piece and everyone expects him to be the leading scorer and the highest usage guy. So if they're butting heads on style and philosophy, yeah, then that's going to be a big story and something they're really going to have to work over. Amori, it's really on him to compromise as the player and try to fit his game into the system.
Well, you talk about Hardy's usage. That was a focal point of a recent article that you have out. What was it, 61 things, 62 things to look for? It was a big number.
I think it was 68.
68, okay.
Because that's a significant number for college hoops, I guess. That's why we went up to 68,
okay.
Maybe.
All right. Well, we got plenty more to get to from that article, including how many three-pointers will this team make and what will UNLV's longest winning streak be? That is Mike Grimala here on set. I'm Ryan McKinnell. This is Cofield & Company. We are about 15 minutes away from handing it off to John Sandler and Curtis Terry for the UNLV Running Rebel pregame. But when we come back, we're going to talk more with Mike about this upcoming game against Indiana. What is it? Purdue-Fort Wayne.
Purdue-Fort Wayne.
Is Ooey-Pooey still Indiana
IUPUI?
University?
Yeah, I don't know what they're called. but this is not them.
Well, I guarantee you they don't have as good a mascot as the Mastodon. All right, plenty more coming your way here on Cofield & Company. 15 minutes until we hand it off to the UNLV Running Rebel pregame show. And look at that. Tyler Brischoff bringing along. Oh, Mike, we got $2 tacos. We might have to talk about that when we come back. This is Cofield & Company here on a Tuesday.
Join the conversation on Twitter at Cofield & Co. Now, back to Cofield & Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
All right, we are back here down at the Thomas & Mack, just a few minutes away from handing it off to the Running Rebel pregame crew with John Sandler and Curtis Terry. I'm Ryan McKinnell holding it down for Cofield. He's down there doing his sideline duties. Got Mike Grimala here across the way. And our good buddy Tyler Bischoff just dropped off some $2 tacos. You are looking at it like it's a bag of arsenic. You want nothing to do with this taco, Mike Grimala.
No, I mean, you...
You inspected it. You looked at it. You peeled back the little... Are those tomatoes?
Yeah.
Yes, Mike.
I'm trying to ascertain, like, what exactly is in this and what is appealing to people about it.
Mike, it's tomatoes, cheese, olives, lettuce... and taco meat.
Like I said to you during the break, the only thing in there that I've had before is the cheese. Like nothing else in here interests me.
First of all, you blew my mind with you've never had tomatoes. We can now push that aside because are you leading me to believe that you've never had taco meat?
I have. I tried a taco once, but it was on the air as sort
you,
of like a
You
stunt.
Spend time with this guy. I don't know, Mike. Like, I just talked to Mike on the radio. Like, you... I'm talking to Tyler right now.
It's...
What's your Subway order?
It's turkey and on a turkey on like a sub roll.
What's it?
Just turkey and nothing else.
No lettuce.
Dry. Just yeah. Dry turkey.
Do people like call the authorities when you leave? Like, do you have like people tailing you? Are you do you watch out for that?
No, it's
this is all very concerning, Mike.
It's
I know it's your world.
I've
it's not,
made it. Yeah. I've made it this far without tomatoes.
Okay.
So it's like at this point, what am I missing?
How old are you?
I am 37.
My God, you're older than
so
me.
So like, I don't need tomatoes. I've made it this far without trying an olive.
You look younger than me. Like maybe that's the key, Tyler. Maybe the key to all this was not eating vegetables.
That is basically the TB12 method. Is like no tomatoes, no olive, right? Isn't that?
Yes. All right, we got a couple minutes left to go here before we hand off to the running rebel pregame squad. Listen, let's just talk hype. Listen, I'm excited. I follow the team, not obviously as closely as you do, but I love everything that I've seen from Coach Otzelberger. I love his, you know, his drive, his focus, the things he says, the way he's involved in the community. When we talk about hype, Mike, right? What is this like prior to the other seasons you've covered here in the Valley?
It's much, much different than when, say, Marvin Menzies was hired, because just the way the coaching search went down with Marvin Menzies, where he.
The chaos.
You had big names. You had Mick Cronin. He backed out. You had Chris Beard. He backed out. You had big rumored names. And then Marvin Menzies sort of felt like the fifth or sixth option. And you sort of got stuck with him, even though that's not fair to Marvin. But that's what it felt like. No one in the fan base was, you know, excited for, can't wait to see what Marvin Menzies does with his team. Because he's also not a guy who has like an exciting style. That's not really his thing. Whereas T.J. Otzelberger is completely different. He's a young coach. He's had a lot of success. He's up and coming. He could be anything. He's basically the mystery box. In the short track record that he has is really good. He plays an exciting style. It's modern. It's new. So just from the perception of when they were both hired, like there's no comparison. People are much more excited about T.J. Otzelberger. But the question is, are you excited enough to come out and pay to get into the building and watch the games? Because that was probably the biggest indictment of Marvin Menzies over the last 3 years is just people weren't interested. They weren't interested in what he was putting on the court.
Yeah, we said mystery box, right? I like that from the standpoint. What if the box ends up and it's not what people thought in terms of maybe a more underwhelming, right, sort of a result? I feel like with his passion and his style of play and the way he gets out in the community, I feel like he has a little bit more of a leash than, say, a Marvin Menzies or maybe even some coaches that have come before.
Yeah, and I'm not saying he's not a mystery box is a bad thing.
I mean,
Chris Beard was a sort of same sort of resume, short, quick turnaround, and 2 years later, he's the best coach in the country. I'm not saying that's going to happen with T.J. Otzelberger, but he's got that upside. You can dream on the upside because he might be the next big thing in coaching, and you've got him for a few years. So that's sort of the exciting part about it.
That is Mike Grimala. Keep a lookout for him. He's got a piece up right now. You can check it out on Twitter and The Sun. It is 68 things to watch out for here in the UNLV upcoming running rebel season. That is going to do it for us. We're out here at the Thomas and Mack UNLV getting ready to throw down. It is $2 taco night. Taco Tuesday. I can't do it. I can't do the LeBron. I want to. I can't. All right, coming up next here on Cofield and Company. Well, it's not going to be Cofield and Company. It's going to be the UNLV running rebel pregame show featuring John Sandler and Curtis Terry. We'll be back tomorrow. See you then, friends.